Good morning, all. I'm Charles Nesson. I'm a faculty member at Harvard Law School and faculty director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society here at Harvard Law School. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to Harvard Law School. This room that you're in was the original library of the Harvard Law School. It goes back many, many years, and you can find photographs around the place of people in green eye shades studying away in this very room. It now serves as our courtroom and as our meeting room, and so it's a pleasure to welcome you to it. Law has always played a role of ordering our liberties. The order part of it has had much to do with property, and the liberty part much to do with privacy. And in 1994, in a conversation with Nicholas Negroponte, he urged the formation of some study group at Harvard Law School to look at the issues of law in relationship to the development of the internet world. It was his observation, and I think a good one, that law will be very much a part of the architecture of the future internet, as much as technology, and that in the architectures of law, we will actually work out the details of our freedoms and our controls. It was in that conversation as well that he pointed to the two most fundamental problems that this environment presents to the law. One is a challenge to our notions of property, the other to our notions of privacy. From the first moment at which the value of digital property became severed from the physical embodiment of it, the record, the tape, the book, the thing that could be controlled and monitored with the traditional laws of trespass and tort. As soon as that separation took place, a fundamental challenge arose for the law. And it's a challenge that continues in a tension that we have not yet seen resolved. It's currently very much alive in the courts, in the disputes over Napster and behind Napster, Nutella, and ultimately a question whether the interests of property can afford to have an open network, whether the interests of property can afford to allow people on the net to communicate with each other digitally without being monitored in a way that determines whether they are dealing in some form of illicit property. And it's that segues right to the issue, the other fundamental issue of privacy. We need to remember, I think, that as we're talking about economic development, we're talking about building out an environment. This is not an environment that exists. It's one that we create. And the architecture with which we build it very much determines what it will be like to live in this environment. At the moment, we give every impression of building a surveillance network, a network that is not only electronic in its character, but one that is also characterized by massive processing, massive connectivity, and massive sensing ability, so that the totality makes a surveillance network. I suggest that as we think about the work of this conference, which is really looking to the challenges and opportunities of building out the network, we also keep in mind, as a qualification, the thought that along with building out the network comes some cautions, comes some concerns. How we construct this network will determine what the balance will be, not only for ourselves, but for those to whom this network is extended, between order and liberty. I would like to presage what is coming here today by reference to some remarks by H.T. Kung. H.T. Kung is a professor at Harvard, a network professor, one whom we recruited from Carnegie Mellon some years ago. He founded Harvard's Internet and Society Conference Series, which is an ongoing series. I know that some of you have participated in them in the past. And as he founded it, he said something that has stayed with me for the time since. He said that technology is not the hard part. We know how to do that in some deep sense. And in 20 years, the technology will be as ubiquitous as we now feel the phone to be. The hard part is the layers of government, education, business, and law that we build on top of the network. There is the challenge. And it's that challenge that it seems we are in part here to address today. The sessions that we have coming up during the day, government, education, and business, fall right in that pattern. And so I look forward very much to the day as it unfolds. I want to close by thanking a couple of people. First, thank you very much to our co-sponsors at the Media Lab and the Center for International Development, and particularly to Mike Best from the Media Lab and Colin McClay from CID, who've just done tremendous work. And I'd like particularly to thank Meg Smith. Meg Smith is our own Berkman Center fellow, and she has just worked tirelessly to make this event happen. And so, if you would, I'd ask you to just join me in a thank you, a little round of applause for the three of them. And now I'd like to turn the microphone over to a dear friend and colleague, Mr. Eric Saltzman. Eric has just joined us as the new executive director of the Berkman Center, and he too would like to say a few words to you. So thank you very much and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for coming over here to Harvard Law School. Yesterday over at MIT, we were all treated to, if not the opportunity to play with all their toys, the vision of them, and here we are in a room where we have to use more of our own imaginations to look into the future than MIT affords us. Yesterday morning, in one of the sessions I attended, the moderator discussed the idea of the internet and e-development as the last ticket on the last train of development for many countries. And she said that that opportunity was greeted with the combination of fear and desire. The desire was to get on the train and move along into a better world for the people of all those countries, and the fear was that if they missed the train, they would fall behind farther than ever before. I want to urge upon us and think through with you that when we talk about e-development, we're still surely talking about more than e-commerce. The internet, as everybody has observed, is a global resource of shared information that will challenge not only our abilities to build a technical infrastructure, but also the values that we care about and the social norms that we've been living with in different societies around the world. It's going to challenge our ability to deal with those questions, and that really have been the issues that the Berkman Center has been interested in. It's doing so in the United States, which is maybe at the top of the heap in the digital age. We've got all sorts of questions here we haven't figured out. I want to talk about just a few of them. One of them is the question of sovereignty. Nations will find, they already are, that the notions of sovereignty that they've dealt with for many, many hundreds of years are beginning to flake apart. We see this in taxation, we see it in small areas like internet gambling, and countries literally don't know how to deal with this. And one of the things that it affects, of course, is the degree to which they feel themselves open to the internet. That's that desire and the fear again. They see that they have to get on board and they fear what it might do to them as well. There are other areas that we are dealing with. Hundreds of years ago, during the Industrial Revolution, I don't want to go far back as Gutenberg, which people talk about, but during the Industrial Revolution, property up to that point was considered more or less inviolable. And the notions of property were challenged again, as they are now, when a mill owner, to drive the paddle wheel in his mill, needed to flood upstream so that he could have a head of water to bring down through his mill and power the mill on a regular basis. So here we are with an early definition of the word upstream, a word we're dealing with all over the place now. And what happened in order to enable that revolution to move forward is that the laws of property changed, and that it was permissible to flood upstream. There may be damages that had to be paid to the owner of farmland upstream, but the mill pond could be created. So now we have a similar situation where the laws and the understanding of how we deal with them may have to change so that the turbines of this revolution can be powered by information flowing from upstream to downstream. And actually, I think many of you would say in this situation, in all directions. So some of the questions we're dealing with, which were touched on by Professor Nessen, are how will that power, how will that water or information flow be metered? Will it be metered in terms of who can pay for it? Will it be metered in terms that we're beginning to see at the Berkman Center and others see as well, in one trading bits of privacy and anonymity for information, so that what seems to be free is really not free, and one is giving away a relationship to government, to corporations, that one had seen differently before. The Berkman Center also is dealing with questions of learning and teaching on the internet. In fact, I think what we could say is what the Berkman Center has cared about from the beginning, and largely under Professor Nessen's guidance and vision, is the understanding of a commons in the internet. Across the street, literally across the street, Massachusetts Avenue, if you have a time on this nice day, you can walk there, as others have walked before, is the Cambridge Commons. And the Cambridge Commons was a place where hundreds of years ago the public was free to graze sheep. And then now it's a place where people can walk and talk, spend time outside, exchange ideas freely. You may do so this afternoon if you wish. The question is, what kind of commons will the internet be? Will information be exchanged freely in the same way that we're used to now? Will the models of information moving back and forth be preserved? Will new ones be developed? Certainly they'll be developed. But will they be models that enhance the values of the society we've come to care about? Or will they be a different kind of transfer that changes our society? We're over here at a law school today, and I think these are some of the issues that will come up in the conversations that we'll have today. So thank you again very much for coming over here. And I want to turn over the microphone to Colin McClay, who will organize the rest of the meeting. Thank you.
Good morning. Just a few brief words here to introduce our moderator this morning for the first panel, Anne Marie Slaughter, who's professor of international law at Harvard Law School, director of graduate and international legal studies. and is currently working on a book about networks of regulatory officials and judges operating internationally. So we're very pleased to have her here today.
Good morning. Our panel this morning is on e-government, and I think probably consistent with the e-age, it's going to be somewhat improvisational. The panel is a rather different panel than the one listed. We've had a couple of last-minute cancellations, unfortunately, due to transatlantic air traffic control. So I will introduce this panel, but then I'm going to be relying on all of you to make this as lively a conversation as possible. I have to admit that standing up here in my law professor mode, I have this irresistible desire to start calling on people, but I will try to refrain. So our panel is on e-government, and one of the great aspects of this conference, and certainly of our panel this morning, is that it's a global audience. But I can't resist making a parochial reference to start out, because as I thought about e-government, I thought, well, let's imagine that that had been one of the topics in the presidential debates that the United States has just gone through. And I thought Al Gore, of course, would have said e-government means putting government online, as he and his Reinventing Government program no doubt tried to do. And George Bush, of course, would have said e-government means basically reducing the role of government as much as possible and outsourcing as many functions as possible. And then we would have had the clear difference, et cetera. But in fact, when you think about it, e-government is likely to mean both. It obviously will mean putting many government services online, but it is also likely to mean a changing role for the private sector in providing various government services. And of course, that means a changing role between public and private, and really a change in our very definition of what the public-private line is, something that legal scholars are fond of talking and writing about, but here it's actually happening. So what we're hoping to do this morning is to have a discussion not only about efforts to put government online and to use government in various modernization efforts, but also with regard to the ways that that does change the role of the private sector and ways in which government can enhance the growth of private internet activity or hinder it. We also hope that we'll focus on a lot of the obstacles to e-government. This is an area in which we hear a lot of rhetoric, but several of the people on our panel, and I imagine many of you in the audience, know that it's much harder to get there than it seems, and the precise location of the obstacles is very important. They are, of course, often highly political, sometimes economic, and again, one of our panelists is well placed to address those. I want to introduce the panel now, and then I will introduce them. I'll just give them their cue to speak. I'm going to ask them to open with a brief opening statement. We've been defining what brief means, but we'll that's right. And then I will pose a couple of questions to the panel, and then I'll open it up for comments and questions from the audience. And as I said, I hope that we can have a real conversation. The architecture of the room is well disposed for that. So our first panelist, I'm going to introduce them in the order that they're going to speak, is Claudio Arrego, who has the wonderful title of By Minister of Housing and City Planning and National Property in Chile. So, of course, my first question to him was, what is By Minister? It simply means he wears two hats. He has two ministerial positions, or two portfolios, for both housing and city planning and national property. He has been the executive director of the Interministry Committee for Modernizing Government, or in public administration, and he has been on the front lines of how you use internet technology to, dare I say it, reinvent government, certainly to improve it. But his focus, as he will probably tell us, has been first on modernizing, and that has led him into an emphasis on the technology. So in his case, the modernization effort came first, but the two are intimately related. Our second speaker is N. Vital, who is the Central Vigilance Commissioner of Government of India and heads the Central Vigilance Commission. I have to say this is a fairly frightening title to anyone. It doesn't mean Big Brother. It means the opposite of Big Brother. It means a campaign to try to make government more accountable to the people. Vigilance meaning vigilance over government to try to reduce corruption. Now, anytime we talk about the internet and e-government or improving government services, we hear a lot about the values of transparency and efficiency, which means reducing corruption. Not surprisingly, we're likely to hear about all the vested interests in trying to block that initiative. Commissioner Vital has had a long career in government service in India and has also been involved in modernization efforts and also in telecom reform. So he has had a wealth of experience on a variety of different aspects of our topic. Our final panelist, who is not in your program, is George Sadowski, who's the Vice President for Education of Internet Society. He has just retired from NYU, where he oversaw computing, and has had a long career in consulting for the UN on technology transfer. This is a obviously an important issue for not only the UN, but other international organizations, how not only what kinds of protocols you develop for how you improve government service, but how in the consulting process you can actually make this happen. So he will speak third, and he will focus specifically on the regulatory impact of government in helping or hindering the development of e-commerce. With that, I will turn the podium over to Minister Orrego.
Do you mind if I speak from here? Okay, thanks. Well, good morning for everyone. I want to thank the sponsors of this conference for the invitation and, of course, for the pain of the trip up here, which is important for a public servant. I want to share with you three, I wouldn't say conclusions, but at least main ideas that I have drawn from my experience both as a modernizer, as a minister, as well as a social activist working in some Chilean slums and trying to use the internet technology to improve the quality of life of poor people. I will try to focus on these ideas and then mention some of the obstacles we have faced or we're facing and some of the things we have done or are doing in order to overcome those obstacles. To start, just a couple of facts. Chile has lived the last 2.5 years a very intense incorporation of IT in its government business and in its country business. In 1998, we had only 200,000 people connected to the internet in Chile out of 15 million. 2 years later, we have 2 million people connected to the internet. At that time, we have 10 government websites. Now we have over 500 government websites. In 1998, we had none government service whatsoever online. Now we have more than 25 government services online, which are, they vary in how important they are, but at least they're relevant information for the people. So with these facts, let me tell you what I have learned, what we have learned. First, and I want to challenge some assumptions made yesterday in the panels, I think government has a critical role in order to use IT as a strategic tool for development in countries. Not only as a regulator, which is important but not sufficient. You need a deregulated telecommunications market, but that is not enough. So what else do you need to do? You need to have a government that uses IT as a strategic tool itself. However, we have found two main obstacles for that strategic use in the case of Chile. One, the excessive fragmentation of the use of IT in different agencies. This has led to incompatibilities of different agencies, has led to lack of efficiency in the use of scarce public money, and also, more and maybe more important, has led to lack of national policy on the use of IT. One example, we realized in 1998 that we have done something on the IT in government. We had 17 national intranets of different agencies, only one single problem. They couldn't speak to each other. They were autistic intranets. we're spending $14 million in connectivity that only allowed for 50% of agencies to be connected at a rate of 64 kilobytes per second on average. One of the things we realized, even though this was kind of resisted by different agencies, that we needed some common ground for this. And one of the things we did, which was the first step, and we're in the process of implementing that, was to create one government intranet that will at least connect everyone. We realized that we could spend less than one-fourth of what we're spending, $3 million, in order to have one government intranet that will provide services to 100% of the agencies and at a rate of 10 megabytes per second. This is one example. We had it also at the website side. Everyone was doing their websites. No citizen, no public servants, no academics could search those different websites. They were out there. Nobody knew how to search them. So why don't we have one portal? One, you know, statewide portal. Estado.cl is the one we have. So people can search, you know, all the agencies by alphabetical order, by, you know, different services, by information, by the structure of government. So we created that, and now we have one government portal with all the services on them. But then, and maybe more important, we didn't have any policy. And I would say in certain areas, we still don't have. And it seemed like IT was a matter of practitioners. You had to do things. You don't have to think about things. You don't need a vision of what you want to do. We realized that we couldn't go further without that vision. And President Frey, in 1998, created a presidential commission with people from business, from the opposition, from labor unions. And we worked for 6 months in order to create a government and a national vision of what we wanted to have the IT as a tool for Chile. You can search that in our government webpage. But the important thing is we were able to manage to have different sectors of the society to have this common vision, and that has helped us. And of course, it wasn't only a conceptual vision. It ended with 12 golden nuts suggestions for government and society that we ought to be doing, and some of them we're implementing that right now. And the second obstacle I want to mention in terms of this critical role of government as a user of IT was the lack of good content and services online. I completely believe that this is a supply-driven market, that unless you have good content and services, people will not get connected. Therefore, you cannot make decisions on the basis of what is the demand out there. There's no demand. There wasn't in Chile demand for our IRS filling, electronic filling, in 1998. On the contrary, lawyers, sorry to say that here in this honorable room, accountants hated this. And they even, you know, went to trial against the IRS for this issue. We had, the first year, 20,000 fillings. This year, 2000, we had 750,000 fillings. This is a huge amount. We didn't have data on how many enterprises were connected. Now, all the big and middle enterprises in Chile are connected. And it wasn't because of their demand, it was because of the supply of content. What else can we do in the future? That is something we have to work out in different agencies. We in the housing ministry are thinking and are doing, what can we do with the 450,000 people that are applying for our subsidies? What if we put them online? What will do the municipalities? Right now they have to go to my ministry's offices in every city of the country. What if they could go to every municipality to get the information online, even if they didn't have a computer? That is the type of things we're trying to face now. But unless we have good services and good content online, people won't get connected. I'm going to hurry up. Second idea, we need to politicize IT. If we don't, those who resist the use of IT and its democratic implications will win. People need to understand that the more radical and important reforms that you can have in terms of democratic values with internet aren't easy, have cost, and how people will resist them. So unless the political elite understands that this is important for democratic process, we won't be able to move forward. In the case of Chile, for many years, we weren't able to show the political elite that this was important. And mainly because we didn't have any real life examples to show them. Now we have one, but we don't have that many. The one we have is our e-procurement system online, which we tried for many years to pass it through because of its efficiency gains, because of its transparency gains, but then because of a scandal in the country, when people and the country was shouting for anti-corruption issues, we saw the window of opportunity and we went forward. And now with this, we have this government-wide e-procurement system that currently is not doing e-commerce, actually. It's just putting the information out there, but the whole process until the results. That is really changing the way we do business in government. And is right now considered the most important anti-corruption measure of the government. And last but not least, as people say, something we have learned is that it's very difficult, I would say impossible, to underestimate the importance of leadership and qualified human resources in order to make this challenge something happen. First, we have found obstacles for this. And the first obstacle is the lack of understanding of the political elite of the economic, political, and social consequences of the implementation of IT as a strategic tool for the country. If I would say something, we need to invest in the awareness of the political elite. How much money we spend only, you know, getting around with people that we already are convinced with the issue? If we only spend a little bit of money trying to show, you know, politicians the importance of IT and the role they have played elsewhere, we must be doing a lot of things in order to advance. Also, the golden nuts, they need results, not only ideas. So it's better to have small, short-term results and prove them to be useful for the country and then move forward. Second obstacle, the lack of experience of managers. Unless you renew the whole body of managers in government, most of them are not used with IT, and they resist and they have fear. We just created in the Ministry of Housing a program where we are hiring students of engineering for 2 weeks to work and serve with all the leaders of the ministry throughout the country. They have to be with them, just serve. That's the only thing they have to do. Serve for, you know, 3 hours a week and talk to them two extra hours. And each director of the agencies throughout the country has to write a 2-page memo afterwards of how can they use IT to improve their business. We need to help managers to get into to grasp IT. It's very difficult. Third, lack of policy-making capacity and technical capacity in government. We have outsourced a lot in Chile, but you cannot outsource policy-making capacity or control capacity. We have tons of millions of pesos because we didn't have the capacity to be counterparts. So we need to reinforce or strengthen or sometimes even create the capacity of the state to think these problems, regardless of who is doing the practical work. If you just outsource very fast, you might outsource the capacity of the state to think over this issue and keep on developing policies. And last, we lack the social expertise. I was involved in a project in a slum in Chile. We have been working for two years. It's called El Encuentro Community Center. And we wanted not only to be a cyber cafe for poor people, there are plenty of them, we wanted to be a community center where we could empower people. Then we realized that we didn't have only a technological gap. We had a cultural gap. We had a generational gap. The people that were coming to the center were kids. And we wanted the community leaders. We wanted the micro-entrepreneurs. And we realized the type of expertise we needed, we didn't find it. It was social expertise, not technical expertise. People that were able to work with, you know, poor people that were out of the technological mainframe and try to walk them in using this as a political, community, and economic tool. We have improved. Right now we have the micro-entrepreneurs webpage. They're selling their products. But it's been difficult and because we didn't have that expertise. Thank you.
Thank you. As someone who manages our international and legal studies program, I would love one of your engineering students for several weeks, and I'll be happy to write the memo. So now we're going to hear from, in some sense, the other side, although Commissioner Vital is a member of the government. As I said in introducing him, his responsibility is holding the government to account. So we're going to hear from him.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. I must thank the Center for International Development, Harvard, for giving me this opportunity to come and say in 5 minutes, to begin with, what we are doing in India, and particularly our idea of what is e-government. In India, when we talk of e-government, we are using this expression, smart government, because application of information technology everywhere use the word smart. We had smart bombs and smart cards and so on. Now, when we in India use the word smart government as being e-government, we talk about small, moral, accountable, responsive, and transparent government, smart government. These 5 points I want to place before you are this. Firstly is, we must realize, when you apply technology anywhere, the only thing we can predict about technology is its unpredictability. Michael Faraday, at the end of the 19th century, when he demonstrated in the Royal Society his electromagnetism invention, I think Gladstone was also there. And the question was asked, how good is this new invention of electromagnetism? Faraday's answer was, how good is a newborn child? We don't know. Then Gladstone went on insisting, no, what is the use of this technology? Then Faraday said, look, I do not know what is going to be used, but as a member of parliament, I can tell you, one day you will be able to tax it. So this is the unpredictability of using technology. Now, one of the things I have done as the Central Vigilance Commissioner was, I always believed in transparency. So what I did, in the internet, we have a website, cvc.nic.in. I put the names of the senior public servants, officials who were facing corruption charges, either in a court of law or in the department. Now, this created what I will call an exercise in serendipity. Now, serendipity is a word that goes back to 1748 or so, when Horace Walpole wrote a novel called Three Princes of Serendip. Serendip is Singhla Dweepa, that is, Ceylon. Three princes go and they make discoveries which are totally, you know, happy results. That's why serendipity. Now, by putting the names of the child officers on the website, I had the experience of serendipity, because suddenly people all over the world realized this is the first time information technology and internet have been invoked to fight corruption. Time and Newsweek wrote stories about it. They call it e-shame. Now, one of the reasons why corruption flourishes, at least in India, is there is no sense of shame. But this brought a sense of shame. Secondly, it had a good deterrent effect. Thirdly, it also helped me to expedite things, because I then started sending every month reminders of the cases pending in the different departments. And as a result, the speed has gone up. And first time in 36 years, this organization is 36 years old, we now know how many cases are pending, where and what not. So first aspect to understand is, when you apply information technology in government, you're going to get very surprising results, these unpredictable results, but I think generally it is good results. So there's the first point I want to make. The second point is, this whole discussion is going on about e-development and digital divide. Now, I'm sure all of you are familiar with the concept of Alvin Toffler's three waves of development, that is the agricultural wave, then the industrial wave, and the post-industrial wave. We are all in the post-industrial wave. But when you come to India, India is somewhat like a snake whose head is in the 21st century and tail is in the 17th century. You see, India, a billion-strong country, has all the three waves of Alvin Toffler, the industrial wave, the agricultural wave, and the post-industrial wave. And this, in turn, gets translated into not only a digital divide, you can say a chronological divide or a wave divide. Also, therefore, you find India has 25 states and 6 union territories, and not all states are equally advanced. So information technology, when you apply in government, may help to bridge the digital, not only the digital divide, but the digital divide can help to overcome, shall we say, the chronological divide. And here is another important point, particularly in a country like India, is being latecomers to technology, we have the advantage of the latecomer, and not the, you know, in IIT and .com, you're always talking about the advantage of the first comer. In India, we are realizing the advantage of the latecomer, in the sense you can use IT or I mean any technology to leap forward to intermediate stages of growth. That is the second concept I want to place before you. Now third, we come to actually what is happening by applying information technology in government to get smart government, and what are the results? We have already seen one aspect. The other aspect is there have been very successful applications for the last 20 years of, for example, the computerization of the railway reservation system. India has the largest railway reservation system, railway system in the world, 63,000 kilometers. I think 10 million people or so travel every day. So it's a very huge organization. And railway reservation has been very successfully done. And that is where we come to this smart concept. Small government. Now, the same number of people who were handling the reservation system 20 years ago are handling three times or four times at work without increasing the staff. Otherwise, government is known for Parkinson's law. We all know. Work expands to fill time available. So, to overcome Parkinson's law and keep the government strong, we have the successful example now. Today, I entirely agree with my colleague from Chile that we need political sensitization to succeed. And our Prime Minister says IT is India's tomorrow. Today there is a lot of hype about IT, and chief ministers and ministers are competing each other to use IT in government. Then second is, we found that by using IT in government, we also can overcome some of the standard excuses for non-performance. One of the important aspects is people saying, oh, we didn't get a copy of that circular. Now that everything is on the website, I have got 65,000 branches of banks, nobody can say I have not got that circular because it's on the website. So some of these standard excuses for non-performance in bureaucracy can be overcome. Then thirdly, citizen, after all, we are a democracy, citizen interface improves. For example, in Kerala, where I am also advising, at one central place, they have kept a center called Friends, fast, reliable, instantaneous delivery of services, network for delivery of services. And instead of people standing in huge queues, they can come and make payments there. But then it also reveals the mindset of the people. None of the senior officials who are concerned with those departments have visited the site. Not only that, in India, I think it's everywhere true in the world, the better is the enemy of the good. So these secretaries who have not seen the center, they say, why do we start with front-end computerization? We should do back-end computerization. But at least the public are welcoming it. Public interface has improved. Then we go to the next concept, namely that there's a final concept I want to keep, that we have identified, if you want e-government in India to succeed, six C's are needed, letter C. One is computer density, second is connectivity, third is content, fourth is cyber laws. Incidentally, India is one of the few states which has got an Information Technology Act, which has recently come into operation. Second country in Asia and 12th country in the world to have an IT Act. Cyber laws, then cost, how to keep the cost less, and finally, common sense. So, computer density, connectivity, content, cyber laws, cost, and common sense. These are going to decide the shape of information technology-enabled smart government to come in India. Thank you.
Thank you. Our fourth panelist has arrived. I'm going to introduce him and give him just a few minutes before he has to make his opening statement, since George Sadowski is our next speaker. He is Dennis Gilhooly, who has arrived from New York. The shuttle traffic was good to us this morning. And he has spent also a great deal of time advising through the UN governments on technology transfer and building information infrastructure. He is currently an advisor to the UN United Nations Development Program, UNDP, but he's worked extensively in telecommunications, media, and the internet for 20 years as both a journalist for Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal, and then also Teledesic, is that the correct pronunciation, which is the Internet in the Sky satellite venture that was backed by Bill Gates. So he has seen this from the public international sector as well as the private sector, both CEO and media. And he will also give us a brief opening statement simply on his experiences with e-government. And then we'll come back to a general conversation. But our next speaker is George Sadowski.
Thank you very much. And I thank my colleagues for giving me an operational definition of the word brief period of time. And I'll continue to observe that that restriction, because one thing I must inform you as an audience, you're seriously deficient in shyness, and I expect that we'll have a good discussion after we're all done. I want to talk about, in the words of the last speaker, I guess, the tail of the snake, those countries that whose heads are in the 20th century and whose tails are somewhere else, and it doesn't really matter where. And particularly to focus upon Africa, because the one relationship between government and business and government and consumers that matters at the very beginning is whether the concept of e-government, whether the letter E is considered a desirable thing or whether it's considered a threat. When countries start to contemplate going on the internet, they really are faced with some choices, and some of them are very unpleasant. And Jeffrey Sachs, in his opening remarks yesterday, alluded to this, the difficulties of getting the internet established in developing countries. It's an important issue. I'd like to give you a vignette, which I thought was idiosyncratic, but I think represents a fair amount of the experience in Africa. In April, a colleague and I were in Madagascar, working with five of the major universities to hook them up to the internet. There are actually seven. One had already established connectivity, and the other one was small and more rural. And we were able to do this work. We presented a technical plan, and we talked in our work with the PTT and with the recently established regulatory authority, OMERT. And one of our concerns was the ability of the ISPs to support the service to the universities. A little bit of background: the USAID was instrumental in helping to establish initial connectivity in 20 African countries. This was done under a program called the Leland Program, named for Mickey Leland, a congressman who had died in a helicopter crash in Ethiopia. And the USAID made the decision to work with the PTTs in the country. It was probably the only political decision they could make. But in fact, in doing so, even though there were people who argued strongly for policy reform and a policy which would encourage the growth of the internet, the PTTs, I suspect, by and large, saw this as an invitation to monopolize not only the wide area network, which of course they were given, but also the local area extensions to it. And so they saw themselves as the guardian of the internet and its protector, but also its limiter. Governments, of course, have a substantial role in deciding both at the infrastructure level and at the content level what they're going to permit and what they're going to forbid. And their policies can drastically affect the rate at which the internet expands and can provide services in the country. Well, the PTT's reaction was, we understand that that competition is coming, we understand that deregulation is coming, but why not do the airline first? The regulatory authority had just been formed. It was 18 months old. It had its offices in the PTT building. It was composed of ex-PTT staff. The culture was that of the PTT, and this is one can't blame the people for this. This is how they were brought up, but in effect, they didn't know their function. There wasn't a sense of what a regulatory authority should do, what questions it should be concerned about. So, for example, when we raised the issue of wireless communication, it turns out in Madagascar that ISPs are forbidden to use wireless communication, but that any client may use it with abandon. And we asked them why wireless was not considered to be useful. They said, well, we haven't got around to studying it yet. We just don't understand it. We don't know. Well, we asked, what are you studying? And they said, well, we're evaluating Nokia cellular phones to see if they can be made operational in Madagascar. I'm normally not at a loss for words, but I was at that point. So what we have here is is a situation in which people don't understand, even if they want to do the right thing, they don't quite know what it is. And also there are threats which are implicitly hanging in the background. There are two major ones. One is, well, we're going to, if we let the Internet in to the extent it flourishes, we, the PTT, will lose our revenue base. And that's absolutely right. And any attempt to convince government that the PTT won't suffer when the Internet comes in, at least initially, is silly, because the cost of either a fax or a phone call compared with the cost of email for the equivalent amount of information is somewhere between 10 to 1 and 100 to 1. And I'm sure you've seen cost comparisons that go about things like this. The argument against that, of course, is that the opportunity cost of not letting it in is far greater in the long run, and it's greater in the sense that you're going to have increased mortality, decreased educational effectiveness, and a whole bunch of other things ranging across the whole, all the sectors of civil society. That's harder to justify accepting in a short-term political environment, and that's why it's fought. The second threat is that that it threatens established power, and the threat is that the PTT it now enjoys, in still in many countries, a privileged position. There's power, there's money, there's prestige, and all those things are important to the people in the PTT. And the answer to that, of course, is to make the PTT a non-privileged institution by encouraging competition in the country. And that's a terribly important thing, and the job isn't over, even though many of the African countries now seem to be understanding that the Internet is not only here to stay, but it's a desirable thing. Now, what to do with this situation? It's the kinds of things that need to be done are not particularly sexy, because it's really a matter of changing the minds of people, educating, changing, weaning from models that they have grown up in, cultures that they have grown up in, privileges that they have enjoyed, perhaps. And that's done in many different scenarios. Araya Cooley at George Mason University for 8 years in his AFCOM conferences has brought together telecom ministers, PTT directors, et cetera, tried to convince them that this is a reasonable, that these changes are inevitable and it's a reasonable thing to do. The ITU has been involved, although much less so, because the ITU's board of directors is heavily influenced by existing telecommunications carriers. The World Bank, through its InfoDev program, has tried to make sure that people in developing countries are full participants in the regulatory colloquia that take place. But this is slow. This is grindingly slow. The model is an erosion model, and I hope it doesn't take as long as it took, for example, in the millions of years to make the Grand Canyon. But it's slow, and the pessimistic viewpoint is, as we used to say at a large bureaucratic institution that I used to work for, the mortality table is our best friend in terms of modernizing the staff. I hope we don't, I wouldn't wish that on these regulators, but there is a sense that there needs to be new blood, there needs to be change of attitude, and it's slow, it's not rewarding, but it's absolutely necessary. Now, there are forcing factors here that I think are overwhelming. Africa has woken up. I know that at least a couple of you were at Bamako 2000 in Mali in February. The president of Mali gave the closing address. The president of Niger was in the front row. And the president of Mali mentioned Internet, I would say, at least 100 times. Now, this is partially hype. I'm not sure he believes it totally. But the sense is it's here. It's real. It has to be reckoned with one way or the other. It should be exploited. And this is going to have, I think, I think we're at the takeoff point for the change in the regulatory climate. Nevertheless, it still needs help. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Dennis Gahuli.
8 minutes.
I didn't feel the shuttle was particularly kind to me this morning, actually. But okay. I should briefly say what the United Nations Development Programme is. It's the principal operational instrument of within the United Nations family with 136 networks in countries worldwide. That's probably one of the largest global networks in existence, and with about 6,000 employees, most on the ground, who are engaged in pure development activities. And it's been laboring under significant and horrible budget cuts within the last few years, due mainly to a downturn in donor financing from the principal G7 countries. And I'll come on to that later, because there's been much hype in the news recently about the so-called Digital Opportunities Task Force, which the UNDP is going to be closely associated with. I've just got a comment on one of George's remarks there, that I think we have to move a little more quickly than looking for regulatory change from natural causes. I mean, we have to move slightly more quickly in that area. But I'm going to speak. At the UNDP, we do believe e-government is clearly a prerequisite and fundamental in transforming developing country economies. As a user of the technology, the government can be quite radical in terms of pushing change, and it acts as a beacon to other sectors. But I've been asked to speak also on governance issues, both at the national and the global level. Now, one of the problems that we're facing in bridging this digital divide is that there is no empirical evidence really connecting as yet, certainly in developing economies, ICT and growth, or ICT and productivity. I previously worked at the World Bank. In the World Bank, there are economists that simply do not get it at the moment. In the United Nations, we have a similar problem. But there are a number of initiatives which have just been launched in recent months, which are looking to move the whole debate to the next level. As George mentioned, I think most international leaders are now running around with all the proper buzzwords, but they haven't really quite grasped what this means in terms of where their economies will be in the next few years. The problem is that we're really facing a dislocation here. You talk in the United States about hypergrowth in electronic commerce and all the rest, but what we're facing is a new gap emerging. The information gap is actually closing in one sense. We are seeing more telephone lines in terms of penetration of mobile usage, for example. And even in Africa, in the last year or so, we've seen almost all African countries now have at least one ISP. So there is sort of some change happening in that area. Where the dislocation comes is that what's actually happening in the networked economy is that wealth creation is now becoming the distinction between developed and developing countries. And we're looking at a scenario where if certain countries do not get on the train and move with what's going on, there is a real possibility that they will be left behind in a permanent state of e-limbo in terms of moving forward. And this is quite a dangerous scenario, because you already see some signals. Prime Minister Mahathir in Malaysia is always more outspoken than others. But he has pointed to, you know, the potential for a regulatory backlash or e-protectionism in this area if we do not see a concerted attempt for inclusiveness for the developing countries in the networked economy as it emerges. And as I alluded to earlier, the G7 leaders seem to be waking up to this at the moment. They've called for the creation of a Digital Opportunities Task Force at their last summit in Okinawa. And UNDP with the World Bank is going to run the joint secretariat of the DOT Force. They're calling it the DOT Force, which sounds something like an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie in some ways. It's a little pejorative, but we'll try and make it more gentle in terms of its deliverables. And this, for the first time, is attempting to bring all stakeholders to the table. Again, as George said, everybody's paying lip service to the digital divide, but there are still so many grammars and so many languages out there. The e-development scenario is a Tower of Babel. We have to get everyone around the same table and talking the same language in terms of whether you can solve this problem just purely through market forces, which of course is illusory, or what other mechanisms are needed to be put in place to move the agenda forward. And we feel that a new urgency is really needed in the policies and programs to be adopted in the development world. And ICT in particular has to be raised in the consciousness of the entire development portfolio. At the moment, if you look at the World Bank, for example, ICT, apart from some programs at the top, is really not being attacked in terms of the basic connectivity issues which have to be addressed on the one hand, and then moving forwards to really looking at the proliferation of local content on the island. So, you know, basic connectivity right up the scale to content and building an entrepreneurial and venture capital environment where we can really see the linkages between pure economic growth and the use of information and communications technology. Now, where is a new urgency needed? Well, in the area clearly of liberalization and reform, this is not a job which has been finished to date. We're looking at a scenario where people have adopted the mantra of privatization, particularly in developing countries. But in many cases, again, as George said, I think, this is looking at privatized monopolies. We have to be looking at competitive market scenarios in developing country economies. This, again, is fairly controversial within the UN system, but it's something that the UNDP is going to be pushing as we transform our agency to more of a policy and upstream advocacy unit. We have to look at modifying wider commercial codes and regulations to really prepare for cross-border electronic commerce. This is going to be fundamental for the developing countries because they are seeing themselves losing out now in terms of even participating in the debates, for example, within the OECD on electronic commerce. The OECD is taking initiative next year. It's holding a fairly breakthrough conference in Dubai where it's going to be paying for developing country delegates to actually come in and take part in this debate. We need to understand the serious impact of postponing reform and get some kind of empirical data in place just to say, look, if you do not do this, these are going to be the consequences. If we look at programs, we really need to see networking development as a major piece, as I said, of the development portfolio and really integrated with policy measures. There has to be this direct link between policy and programs and moving forward. And we need innovative programs that are really well matched to the local context. We cannot foist centralized or programs on developing countries when we're moving forward. Well, you know, where is the policy development is not sufficient? What kind of programs, what range of programs may be appropriate? Well, I think these are just emerging in terms of looking at the support for increased international connectivity, looking at support for the coverage of marginal areas, beyond the telecenter model, which is really becoming hackneyed and dysfunctional, I think, in the view of many of us have been operating in the field for some time. Support for low-user programs, such as cheap cellular handsets, or even on the fixed side. If you look at fixed-cost communications, we're still looking at price points of around $1,000 a line in most parts of the world, mainly because that's pretty good for the telephone companies because they can amortize plant over a period of 10 or 15 years. And they don't need to cut costs. Now, if we're looking at price points of, say, $200 or $300 in some developing countries, this is going to be quite transformational. So we need to get the private sector and industry on board in saying, look, we are going to deliver technologies at these costs, which are going to allow for leapfrog possibilities within developing economies. We need to look at seed corn financing for application service providers and other small niche ventures with low capital needs in developing countries. Microfinance and microcredit could really be one of the breakthrough areas here. And we need to look at programs that address specific capability gaps, such as IP configurations, HTML creation, and the list goes on. In my own country, Ireland, we have been looking at quite radical policy steps linked to programs in terms of both a top-down approach to this with the buy-in of the head of state or the prime minister and really linking this to very, very fast-moving venture capital type of environments on the ground. And you can see that Ireland, for example, is the fastest-growing economy in the OECD over the last 10 years. I was in Seattle with the Minister of Communications from Jordan. And Jordan has actually taken the Irish model, but even gone the next step in terms of very radical measures in moving forward and transforming the economy in Jordan. And he said down one street in the capital of Jordan, there's now about 100 internet cafes. So there is an explosion happening on the ground in that market. But again, what we really need to look at is a holistic view of how we're moving economies forward. E-government is going to be essential in this, but we also need to link that to educational strategies and training strategies from the beginning, not as in hindsight, just tagging this on at the end. We need to look at very advanced telecommunications competition strategies with 3G wireless, with local loop unbundling, with flat rate pricing. and we need to look at coherent and innovative internet policies, which even in the United States haven't moved to a level of maturity, I would say, yet. In sum, then, there's still a very long way to go before policies or programs are optimized. There's still very slow diffusion of best practice amongst policymakers. There's low levels of innovation across the board. There's a lack of urgency, even where opportunities and threats are greatest. And clearly, that is in sub-Saharan Africa. And we can come back to that, perhaps, in the discussion. In terms of programs, networking is still a poor relation in the development portfolio. We need to change the mindset. There is still low levels of integration of programs with policy progress, and there's suboptimal public and private combinations of the type of partnerships which would really move forward. Again, we can come back to the dot force on that, because I think something is really moving there. Just in sum, though, at the global level, there clearly needs to be really radical and new thinking. ICANN showed that the Internet global governance model was really broke. There's been some good attempts. The Markle Foundation financed developing country delegates to attend some of the ICANN meetings, and we're looking at a transformation in terms of ICANN governance. But look, if you're a developing country and you're seeing the whole of Internet global governance coming out of a Californian company governed under Californian law, well, hello, something's got to change there. And we are potentially looking at real backlash in this area, because at UNDP, we do not believe that developing countries have actually taken on board just what is happening in terms of one country and one governance structure really pushing a market which is going to be the most transformational economic development, certainly of our lives. Just to finish, these two initiatives which have been born in the last few months. One is this dot force, which I mentioned. That's a G8 initiative, which will include developing countries at the table for the first time in these discussions with private sector, multilaterals, and non-profit foundations. The other one is the United Nations Information and Communications Technology, or ICT, Task Force, which is going to be reporting to the Secretary General next year. These two will converge over the next few months, but we really need to, we need your input in this in terms of moving forward, and I think there'll be, you know, some websites set up for input in this area, and I'll shut up there. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we get to questions, I will turn it over to you in just a minute, but I have one of my own, and maybe an additional one. The one of the things we heard this morning, or e-government, not surprisingly, has multiple definitions, and I think when I first thought about it, I think about it in terms of using IT to help government talk to each other. As Minister Arrego immediately said, there were 17 different portals. Well, that's the opposite of what you want. What you assume is that IT technology can facilitate intra-government communications, and then using IT in terms of improving government services outward to government constituencies. So there are those two faces. But as we heard in the presentations, many of our speakers focused on the role of government in developing information infrastructure in the country as a whole, the role of it helping or hindering. And finally, the role of IT in global governance, which Dennis Gilhooly talked about at the end, the importance, of course, of a global political process in determining the ways in which IT will shape our global future, but also something that I work on, as he mentioned, the G8 initiative. Global governance is increasingly network governance. It is government agencies at the international and national level linked up electronically, and often the only really tangible sign of these networks is some kind of website. The one question I wanted to, I want to make a comment, and then one question to push the panel on before we open it up. The comment is just to highlight the tension between Minister Arrego's remarks and Commissioner Vital's, and I think implicit in the other two, which is we started with the idea what we really need to do is convince government officials that this is the way of the future, that you begin by developing a constituency within government. And that's the critical first step before you can even get to all of this improved services and outsourcing government. And then Commissioner Vital said, yes, well, here are the two big advantages of using IT. It makes government smaller, and it reduces corruption. Now, if we're talking about e-development, in many of the countries we're talking about, big government is a good thing, right? The last thing government officials want to hear is they should adopt IT because they're going to remove the need for their own job. And clearly, corruption is often a part of why being in government is valuable. So what I wanted to just comment on there is just listening to the two of you from both your experiences from two different governments, I still hear a big tension and a lot of room on, so how precisely do you sell it to government officials? My comment, and it may pick up on questions you have, my question, and then I'll turn it back to the panel and open to the audience. Minister Orrego made a very interesting proposition. He said we need to politicize IT. It's important to politicize IT. Now, most of the time when I talk about e-government in any way or regulatory frameworks more generally, politicization is a dirty word. That is not what you want to do. You want to try to develop a technical audience. The politicization is just going to make everything harder. So I wondered if other members of the panel wanted to respond to this proposition that what we really need to do, both I think nationally and by implication from what Dennis Gilhooly said globally, is to politicize it. Let me turn it back to the panel.
Actually, on this issue of politicization, I would extend that concept a little more to say, how are you going to bring change in the mindset of the public servants, and who will be the political people? Now, in India, we have experience of both. We had Mr. Rajiv Gandhi, who was himself a technocratic-minded person, and he was the first person who talked about use of computers in government and all that. That was the directive. It was followed. Now, in my capacity as a Central Vigilance Commissioner, I have certain clout. I can force changes. Now, I think in a developing country, a certain amount of force also is needed. For example, out of the 65,000 branches of banks in India, nationalized banks, only 10,000 are computerized. I have asked them that in order to check corruption in banks and frauds, they should all computerize at least 70% of their business by 1st January 2001. You will be happy to know that this is being taken seriously, it is being implemented. So both are involved, and at the level of the civil servants, I think we have to locate champions, and this is where, at least in India, the problem is people who know information technology are not gray-haired people, they are young people, and people who are in senior, in the government goes by the donkey principle of seniority, because as they say, seniority is a fact like maternity, whereas merit is an assumption that can be challenged like paternity. So, but this is a problem, but in a society like India particularly, which is traditional, some states which are a little forward-looking, they have been able to do it. So the mindset change comes by, partly by compulsion, partly by the political thing. But today India is happy because right from the Prime Minister and Chief Minister, as well as the investors in the stock market, Infotech has got on.
Thank you.
Two comments. One, regarding the tension between demand and supply of the use of IT in government. I completely agree with the implication of that tension, in the sense that if you don't have a demand for the use of IT as a tool for more transparency in government, over time, this won't be sustainable. Nevertheless, when you're working within government and you want to push the issue forward, you realize that what you can do, it gets to a certain point, unless there is political commitment from above. So, and especially in a continent like Latin America, where we have a weak civil society, I think if you have any power within government or to press government in order to adopt this technology to move forward to more radical reforms, I think that's the path to take, not to say that you don't need the civil society involvement and social control. And regarding the politicization, of course, I'm not talking about partisan politics. I'm talking about putting the issue on the agenda as a political issue for the country. In many developing countries, and I know this because I've been traveling, IT is still, even though people give lip service about it, a technical thing. It's not a key component of the economic strategy. It's not a key component of the social strategy. Nevertheless, not even the anti-corruption strategy. So unless you are able to push it forward as a key component of these elements, it's very difficult to have it as a key component for the overall development strategy of the country. And just to put one specific example, we had this year, I'm a minister right now, so I'm not only an advocate of these issues, we had the new law, poverty law, that forces every public official to have their interest, personal interest a declaration to make it open. So I said, so we're going to put this on a web page. I said, no. This goes to an office where they will have it. So I say, are we criticized for, I mean, are we, do we have the prohibition of doing it? No. So I put mine on the website of the ministry, but I'm the only one. So if you as a city wanted to get this, you will have to get through a bureaucratic process where really nobody knows where those declarations are. So this is the type of things I think can make a difference.
You will be happy to know I also put my property on the website, and there is a demand, and some of the officers have now started. It's a voluntary disclosure. This exercise has started in India also.
So personal shaming is the. Do you want to comment?
I think your point is very apposite. I don't think we've done a very good job of explaining, you know, if you shrink government in developing countries, why this is to the advantage of people in developing countries. It has to be looked at in a more holistic sense in terms of actually developing a strategic framework at the national, at the local, and also at the international level. We haven't done that. That's what some of these initiatives, which I alluded to, are trying to do. And we need to do a better job of explaining the linkages between ICT and economic growth down the road, the linkages between innovating transparency within e-government and how that will have a knock-on effect across the rest of the economy, which will have virtuous effects. So we really do need to think in an innovative way about this in developing countries. And I do not think it is as simple as in shrinking government in the United States. I mean, the movements here in the last few years just simply will not translate into a developing country context. So I don't think we've figured it out, but we have to focus on this. In terms of politicizing the debate, yes. They've got the buzzwords, they're paying lip service, but what they haven't seen, what they haven't gazed into, what they're not looking down into is the abyss on this. And I think we have to, develop this polarization arguments in terms of looking at the abyss. If you don't do this, this is really what's going to happen at one extreme. And then at the other extreme, the ability to participate fully in the networked economy.
I have a comment which is perhaps tangential, but I think it's interesting. From Dennis's remarks on the need for evidence to show the link between ICT and economic growth, I think that this is prima facie evidence that we have too many development economists in development organizations. In 1985, when the technology revolution started in the United States, there was no link between PCs, the growth of PCs in organizations, and increased productivity. And at the time, I was working at Northwestern University, and the president was an economist, and every time I went into his office and said, these things help, he threw me out. It wasn't until an economist kept saying, there's no link, there's something else is happening. Well, it wasn't until the mid-90s that an MIT economist named Bjorn and showed that the problem wasn't with the evidence, it was with the economic models, and that by disaggregating appropriately, you could show a very strong link. Now, if we say, if our pitch is that there is no evidence, we need to develop evidence between that there's a link between ICT and economic growth, we're blindfolded. That's the blind leading the blind. There may be no direct evidence, but it's there. The linkage is there, and anyone who works in this field sees it. Furthermore, there's nothing that says that you can't shift to another field. For example, is there any direct evidence that the availability of ICTs, the internet, and information in a country improves healthcare? You bet there is. Is there any evidence that the access to all the curricular and information material on the net improves education? You bet there is. Economic growth is not the only thing that we should be selling ICTs for.
Great. Now, I see a number of hands, so what I'm going to ask people to do is that we're going to collect a few questions. Please direct them to a particular member of the panel, if you have one, have them. I'll let the panelists think about which ones they want to respond to, because if we do it one by one, we're never going to get to any. There in the back to start.
Good morning. I'm Nolan Bowie, senior fellow at the Kennedy School of Government. First, an issue of perspective. There are some 6.2 billion people in the world today, and of that number, some 5.8 billion have never gone online. But the 400 million or so who are online shows that there's great opportunities for experimentation to try to get it right. When I hear the term e-government, I think what's implied also is the term e-citizens. I'd like to know, what are the rights and responsibilities of e-citizens, and are they different from ordinary regular citizens? There's an issue of the digital divide or opportunity divide. If government is going to shift toward a electronic mode, how does it reach those people who fall through the net, who may be more in need of ongoing, continuing government services? And can governments afford a redundancy of quality service, both online and traditional? Then there are issues of legitimacy, trust, as well as the fairness in terms of privacy. Will governments actually protect the privacy of citizens or non-citizens who may have engaged in anti-government speech? Anne-Marie raised the question earlier about taxes and online gambling, but there's also a big issue of censorship, and whether we call it obscenity, pornography, indecency, or hate speech. This raises questions, since we're talking about a global network of networks, is whose standards should apply? Which governments, or if not the case of government, which what new NGO or world government agency? Great. My questions.
There's a question up here. I promise I'm going to work my way around here, and either the second this part of the room will get equal time. Here, there in the Nolan was mentioning the taxes point the Commissioner Vital raised. That's another tension where if you tell a government the reason you should do this is because you can tax the citizens, that slightly hampers the citizen incentive to do things.
Hi, I'm Elisa Corentire, the co-founder and program director of Geek Corps. My question is about the relationship with the government and the private sector. And the reason is that when I go and speak to companies who are the main service providers, as Mr. Minister Orego spoke, the service and the quality of service is really a main factor in how much people take advantage of the internet. When we speak to these companies, they're telling us that their main challenge is that the government is not supporting them in pursuing their goals. And I want to ask the panelists, what can government do to meet those challenges?
Right. There are two questions right up here, and then I'm going to let the panelists respond. Here and here.
I'm Pete Knight Moore, Telematics for Education Development, a graduate after 20 years of the World Bank and to the private sector. Dennis, I appreciated the urgency you expressed, and I know your boss, who I worked for a while, is a strategic communicator. However, about a year ago, when the issue of the digital divide came up in a symposium at the World Bank, the idea of what can you do, I stood up and said, well, look, why not an international E-rate for education and health, voluntary? You got bandwidth, give some bandwidth. You got money, give some money, we'll buy more bandwidth from the people who have bandwidth. Well, my question to you is the following. Is .forest going to be another world development gateway to kind of control whose things get to the forum? I was told yesterday when I presented the Global Service Trust Fund with four colleagues, including somebody from UNESCO, well, we just have to wait because until .forest gets around to having a meeting before we can get these things discussed. Now, if we're urgent, I don't know why we can't get a little dark fiber and a little bit of underused transponders devoted with suitable policy conditionality on telecom policies. We all know what a good telecom policy is. Leland worked out a few ideas on that, and it can be done participatorily. Education and health policies also. What's a minimum of good? And let's give away a little bandwidth, folks. Just give it away, and content will come from the places where it's cheap to create content, the people who need it.
Great. Thanks. Right in front of you. Last question on this.
I'm Professor Rashmi Mayur from Bombay, India. I'm the director of the Futures Institute and advisor to the United Nations on development programs. I was happy to come here today because it was e-governance And I understood E as elimination of government. And so I was...
He's on the Bush side of the debate.
I felt that this is the right place. Since I am a believer in the democracy and the people's governance, the government has to go. And actually, government is going anyway, whether we like it or not. I have two questions. One, you're talking about the technology and the meeting that you have organized here of the digital divide. To me, the digital divide is the expression of the divide that already exists. It's nothing new created by IT. And can IT bridge the gap or not is the answer I'm looking for when I came to this meeting. And I wonder by the end of the day, we will find the answer. I think the answer is in a larger scale of what the world we live in, and can we change it? For example, you look at the number of the computers in the world, now close to about 900 million, and you look at the connectivity of the internet. We have 1 billion people in India. We have hardly 1.5 million connected internet connections we have. And the telephones, maybe 30, 35 million telephones with the 1 billion people and about a billion telephones in the world. This divide is a real divide. When we talk about the internet and the computers and the education in the developing world, we are working in villages where people don't even know how to read and write, a billion of them in the world. How do we really do this is the real political question, as the Chilean minister said. And everything about humans is political anyway, as Aristotle said. In this situation, I think the question is what my friend from the UN has said. Is there such a thing as the United Nations? Does it exist after the 7th of September? Around the 7th of September, 189 governments of the world signed a declaration called the Secretary General's Declaration. And there's a global compact made. Now, first time the United Nations made a compact in 1945 with close to 50 governments. This time the governments, United Nations, have made a compact with the private companies. The private companies will be deciding certain things. Who is actually running Indian government or any government in the world? The Suharto's government. It's the private companies are creating governments. So you should read the book or David Cotton's book, How the Corporations Govern the World. So in a way, that is very good. My question is, are the corporations ready, if they are running the world, to really bridge this digital divide? Can they bridge the digital divide or not? And I think that is the fundamental question, and I am hoping that panelists here can really look at the world, not in terms of governments anymore, because it's the corporations which are running the world. And many corporations are digital divide corporations. They are dividing further. And I think our question when we leave here is to see if the governments go away, who is going to bridge the digital divide? Thank you.
Okay, we've had a range of questions. I'm going to turn it back to the panel, and I know there are a couple of people on this side who very much want to get in. You do not need to answer each question posed. You should choose the ones you think you have the most to say on, and if we can keep it brief, we can get a few more comments in. Let's go down the road. George, start.
2 points. First, for the question from Geek Corp. I'm glad you're here, by the way. Yeah. How can government help companies in the developing countries? The model we found that seems to work well is the government needs to energize the private sector to set up conditions favorable for it, the IT private sector, to set up conditions favorable for its growth and then get out of the way. This works really well. The people who live in the country can understand where they can make money, how they can satisfy their own objectives, and then let the government direct what has to be directed to the not-for-profit sector and satisfy those needs also. But government has to give up and let the private sector work. The second thing I'd like to say, and to introduce some controversy, is that the phrase digital divide should be eliminated from the language. I think Gabriel Acacina had it absolutely right yesterday when he said the digital divide is a moral term. It's not a descriptive term. What we have is a social divide, an economic divide, a health divide, an education divide, and we're using this technology to build digital bridges to help ameliorate those divides.
Thank you. Minister Rego.
Okay, 2 points. Regarding the same issue of a digital divide, I'm not quite sure whether IT can bridge the gap. What I'm completely sure is that if we don't do something, it's going to widen. So I think, I mean, it really depends on what you do with IT and how fast you go. And that goes back to what the UN is doing and many other organizations within countries and between countries. I have a fear with task forces. I've seen so many task forces that end on huge reports with no results. You know, I'm more into, you know, let's show what's going on, let's invest money in real life projects, maybe short evaluation, and then move on. I think the cycle of the historic project is not the cycle we can have the luxury to do anymore. And you do need to move forward faster than we're doing right now, and I have a fear with task forces in that sense. And one thing about government and private sector relations, related with the issue of IT industry, I think the best thing government can do is move forward into putting its services online and really make it a good user. That will make a huge demand for the country. And second, for the private sector that is not IT sector, I would say this is the first time I've been working for 10 years in the public sector. It's the first time I feel that I can challenge the private sector for the first time. I mean, I'm going to meetings where I'm challenging them to catch up with us. First time.
I'll take two sets of questions. One was this issue, can IT bridge the digital divide? I'll take the firm stand, IT can bridge the digital divide. Because coming from India, I know, firstly, this digital divide today is a direct result of the difference in the level of development between the late developing countries and others. This has been due, it's a historical legacy. But the IT can be a catalyst by which we can improve our services. For example, one question was asked, what about the citizens who fall through the net? Can the services be improved? For example, in a poor country like India, where we have food security through the public distribution system, you can use digital, technology, firstly, to inform the citizens practically in every fair price shop about the quantity that has come, so that to prevent the siphoning of that food grains and other civil supplies into the black market, and you can improve the quality of the civil the public food security. So one way in which IT can bridge the digital divide is first attacking the problem of development. Second way it can help is, if you see the thanks to Moore's law and the continuous development of technologies, the cost is coming up, coming down. For example, I think Mr. Gelhooli mentioned about the $1,000 per line and the $300. So as the cost is coming down thanks to technology, adopting IT becomes easier for the poorer country. Therefore, I take the firm clear stand that IT can bridge the digital divide. But what we need in IT is the importance of IC. IC is not integrated circuits. It is imagination and commitment. If it is there, we can succeed. One more, the second set, just 1 minute, I'll finish. This issue was raised about e-citizens, then citizens' privacy, all this. Actually, as I see, IT empowers the citizen. So as the empowered citizen, he can be a watchdog on the performance of the government, and particularly in a democratic situation, throw the rascals out when the opportunity comes. So at the same time, about privacy, the answer is very clear. We are, every citizen, forget about government, even in the using the credit cards and so on, so much of your information is already known to the companies, business companies. So people all the time make a compromise. To what extent they want to give up privacy for the benefit of the services? It's a balance going on. So it is not as if there is a even invasion of privacy, etc. It is based on a healthy, dynamic equilibrium.
There were some good questions there. I'm trying to remember them all. I think the first question alluded to citizens' rights, the information revolution. I personally feel that it's no exaggeration to say that the United Nations probably will be incorporating information access and the right of information access as a basic human right within a few years. This is something which to me seems inevitable. Now, when we talk about task forces, I come from the private sector originally, so I mean, the words I usually associate with them are allergic and anathema, and I do agree with you on that. But something is missing here. Look, we have failed miserably to solve this problem. There was a report from the International Telecommunications Union, I think in 1983 or 4, George, correct me if I'm wrong, which is called The Missing Link. I think that was about the digital divide. Maybe it was in the analog era, but it was talking about the lack of telephones. And it had the target to put a telephone in every village in the world by the year 2000.
Right.
What these task forces are going to do, though, I think, is try and look at a new dynamic. And that dynamic, I think, is to try and get these guys around the table who have never actually spoken the same language before. And Specifically, that relates to the question from Geek Corps in terms of public-private cooperation. I think there's been, there's a problem in terms of how we're perceiving public-private cooperation, certainly in the past. In the World Bank, for example, they've stopped lending in telecommunications since 1997. $0 lending since 1997, because they're acting on a policy note which said that basically all of this can be taken care of by the private sector. Well, it's not being taken care of by the private sector. We have to look at very, very innovative public-private partnerships in terms of moving forward. And I think this is what this Digital Opportunities Task Force will do in terms of giving parity and equitable representation to all of the players around the table. The other point is, this is the first time that the G7 leaders have actually owned up to the fact that they have to do something about this. And I think underlying it is this fear of backlash, which we haven't really seen yet, but which is coming down the road, and it will put certain pressure and certain urgency into how we move forward. You mentioned the Global Development Gateway, which is the World Bank has launched and has got tremendous criticism on from some of the NGOs. I think it's a good idea. Okay, maybe it has to change. Maybe it has to become decentralized and represent the NGO community. But I think nobody who's behind that project would say that it's not just one element or one piece in the puzzle in terms of moving forward. Where I think we are lacking and where we have to really address issues is on the issues that this dot force is going to look at, which is network readiness in countries. We have 20 developing countries queuing up for an initiative we've just launched on network readiness, where we'll be offering, say, $1 million pro bono facilities to these countries, basically to figure out what the strategic framework is for them in their countries. This is the first level and the first plank. The second is we have to address basic connectivity. It is not being addressed in an adequate fashion in the developing countries. And for those people who says it's not about connectivity, well, it is about connectivity. That is the first basic thing that we have to fix on the ground. We have to solve the problem of skills and human capacity in developing countries. There is no point in putting a computer out there if nobody can use it. And we have to look at international regulatory and governance issues in terms of full participation. I think this comes to the last question. Are any of these structures going to be in place with the tornado of globalization which is sweeping around the world? I think national sovereignty is on the verge of collapse in terms of the internet economy personally. And I'm not sure what mechanism is going to be in place, but it's going to be very different from the ones we have today.
Thank you. Well, unfortunately, Harvard Law School's state of technology is such that we cannot even operate a basic clock. I had, out of the corner of my eye, looked over and thought it was quarter past. Of course, I didn't realize it's quarter past six. And I am told that we are out of time, and I apologize to those of you on the left side of the room, but I'm told we have to move on. I want to thank our panel. One of the things that came out very strongly was the need to emphasize the last car on the last train, emphasize what will happen if governments don't use IT. But equally important, and I think it is an equally important message, was the importance of emphasizing the benefits at the micro level, that this depends ultimately on individual government officials, and they have to see something in it for them. That may underscore a link between e-government and democracy, because the major benefits for them are improved constituency relations, improved relations with the private sector. Many questions left unanswered. I'm sorry for those of you who did not get a chance to ask your own. I hope you'll come up and ask the panel. Let's give them a hand.
I've got to say something. Mine is not a question. But I will formulate it as a question. Claudio, quiero saber si usted sabe la diferencia entre la palabra politizar en español and to politicize in English. And Marie, we've talked about the gap. In the 2.5 days of listening here at MIT and at Harvard, I have heard beautifully a linguistic gap. The word to politicize in Spanish is a different word than to politicize in English. And we've talked about the connectivity and the gap and so forth, and this was the only time I've heard a really serious linguistic gap in the 2.5 days of enjoying the hospitality of Harvard and MIT. Gracias. Oh, aside from that, I am a retired UNESCO advisor to UNICEF, and I have a lifelong job as UNICEF Santa.
Thank you. Thank you all.
No, no, but you can take it two ways.
That's what I thought. With the UN,